Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what happened is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt. I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way. Your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit, and it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out. He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, "Shoot it!" So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarion Styles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarion can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No. Nope.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
All right, today we're going to talk about, well, anything you guys want to talk about just the season. But the jump-off topic is national forest and privately owned forest. And in our program notes here on Blog Talk Radio, 60%, let's put out this number. There are 10,600,000 individuals, like private citizens, who have set up trusts or in their own name, maybe some are corporate. 60% of the forest land in the United States is privately owned. Maybe somebody who's listening to me right now, you own your own forest. If that idea sounds interesting to you, you don't own forest, there are plenty of opportunities where you can purchase your own forest too. With 60%, which is 10,600,000 individuals in the form of families, individuals, trust, and things of that nature, own the land, the forest land in the United States. 31% of the forest in the United States is federally owned, and 9% of forest areas in the United States are owned by the state. So going far and away ahead of the pack are family-owned, property-owned forests. Now, if you go to our Facebook page, which is It's My House TV, go to our Facebook page, which is, once again, It's My House TV. And let's see. All right. Once again, go to Facebook. Our Facebook page is It's My House TV. And you scroll down, and the what you'll see is I've got 13 pictures, but let's go over them from top to bottom. Once again, you'll see the pie chart. 60% of the forest land in the United States is privately owned, well over half. 30% of the forest areas in the United States is owned by the federal government, 10% by local and state governments. All right, there's a pie chart on that. The next pie chart is an estimated 10,600,000 families and individuals, trust estates, make up the category of family forest and woodlands ownership. They control more forest and woodland than any other group. That's the private folk. And then they break that down into 38% are family forests, 2% are locally owned, that's local governments, 9% are state-owned, 31% is the federal government, and 20% is corporate. All right, so let's see. All right, that's, then we scroll down, there's a picture of me and somebody else's forest building a, we're building a little small building there, tall, it's a tiny house, really. Using Earthship methodology. Then there's another picture of me. Then there's another picture of me building. And then we have my 4 acres of forest. All right, so there's one. There's an aerial view. There's a picture of three men walking the land within my 4 acre forest. Then you see a road. That's the road that brings you to the frontage area. Okay, let's see. All right. As we scroll down even further, I also have, what is the definition of forest according to the United Nations? All right, according to the FAO, the United Nations, forest is defined as land spanning more than 0.5 hectares, okay, with trees higher than 5 meters and a canopy to cover more than 10% of trees able to reach these thresholds. Okay, also another definition is a forest is an area of land dominated by trees. Hundreds of definitions of forest are used throughout the world, incorporating factors such as tree density, tree height, land use, legal standing, and ecological function. Okay, another definition of forest. A forest is a large area of land that is covered in trees. The word forest can also refer collectively to those trees. An area that's covered in trees can be described with adjective forested. Less commonly, forest can be used as a verb meaning to cover an area with trees. Another definition of forest is defined as an environment that is covered with trees at least 5 meters, 16 feet high, over an area of 0.5 hectares and hectares translated, 0.5 hectares is 1.2 acres, which is a bit smaller than the size of an American football field. All right, so you need at least 1.2 acres to have your own forest, according to this definition. You need at least 1.2 acres of land covered, and you have to have trees on that, not just one or two, but, an ample amount. So, and the trees must be a height, or at least grow to the height of at least 16 feet high. So, in the pictures that I saw, that you saw me in, and the ones that I took, those two places qualify as forests. What picture will you see me, that doing the, the tiny house building? That was on a 40-acre, a private forest of 40 acres. All right. And then my 4 acres is, it's just 4 acres, but it does meet, you do see trees there that are taller than 16 feet high. And 4 acres is definitely more than 1.2 acres. So, okay, and I think the last definition I have here, United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization defines the term forest. According to the agency, a forest must be at least 1.24 acres. Trees in a forest must be at least 16 feet tall, and a tree canopy must cover about 10% of the land. Now, I don't know what a tree canopy is, so let me look up something here. Tree canopy. Tree canopy cover. A tree canopy cover, its leaves, branches, and stems that provide the tree coverage of the ground when viewed from above. It is a driving force behind numerous environmental, social, and economic services. Communities plant trees for a number of reasons. So what is a canopy? What is a canopy of trees? Tree canopy means the total area of the tree or trees is where the leaves and outermost branches extend, also known as the drip line. Okay, let's see. Why is tree canopy coverage important? Clean air. Trees produce oxygen, intercept airborne particles, and reduce smog, enhancing community respiratory health. The urban canopy directly contributes to a meeting of the city's regulatory clean air requirements. What is an urban tree canopy? Urban tree canopy is a layer of trees, a layer of leaves, branches, and stems of trees that cover the ground when viewed from above. Okay, I got it. And what are the different types of tree canopies? There are three general types of canopies. Instant canopies, sometimes called pop-up canopies, pole tents. Oh, well, hold it. That doesn't have anything to do with the tree canopy. All right, what percentage? American Forest recommends an average of 40% tree canopy coverage in areas of east of the Mississippi and the southwest by dry west. Oh, in the southwest and dry west, the numbers are 25% to 30% depending on the type of development. Okay. All right, very interesting. Tree canopy. Okay. Anyway, let me see. If you got any questions, 619-768-2945. And what I want to go into a little bit more detail right now, I'm seeing if anybody's on the radar. If you haven't done so already, I want you guys to, and I'm sure some of you already have, but for those who haven't, when you get an opportunity, check out National Forest. Now, let me, before I go to the phone lines here, let me go to Wikipedia. All right, National Forest. In the United States, National Forest is a classification of protected and managed federal lands. National forests are largely forests and woodlands areas owned collectively by the American people through the federal government and managed by the United States Forest Service, a division of the United States Department of Agriculture. The United States, the U.S. Forest Service is also a forestry research organization which provides financial assistance to state and local forestry industry. As of 2020, there are 154 national forests in the United States. out of the 50 states, 40 states have national forests. 10 states don't have them. All right? Let's see. And some of these areas within these national forests contain wilderness. And you can even live or camp in some of these places on a part-time basis. Let's see. Okay. Let's get a list here. All right, national forests by state. Let's hop to it. All right, national forests. Alabama has 4 national forests. And these are all listed online, and all of them have websites. But Alabama has 4 national forests. Alaska has 2 national forests. Arizona has 6 national forests. Arkansas has 2 national forests. California's got a whole slew of them. They have 18 national forests. If you're living in a high, very expensive area like Los Angeles, the Inland Empire, you know, or the Bay Area, San Francisco, I would suggest visit a national forest and become a camper. All right, Colorado has several of them. Now, Connecticut doesn't have any national forests. Delaware doesn't have any national forests. Florida, where I'm at, we have 3. Now, I've been to one of them. We have Apalachicola National Forest that's over in the Florida Panhandle. Then there's Ocala National Forest, and I've been there. And then where we have our 4 acres in the northern part of the state is Osceola National Forest. Now, by our 4 acres, within maybe 20 minutes or so, we have Madison State Park, which is a phenomenal place. And then 35, 40 minutes in the eastern direction, there is Osceola National Forest, which contains a wilderness area within it. And I'll get to that in a moment. Georgia has Chattahoochee-Okanee National Forest. Hawaii doesn't have any national forests. Idaho has a slew of them. Illinois has Shawnee National Forest. Indiana has Hoosier National Forest. Iowa doesn't have any. Kansas doesn't have any. Kentucky has 1, 2, 3. Including Daniel Boone National Forest. Louisiana has 1 national forest. Maine has 1 national forest. Maryland has no national forest. Massachusetts has no national forest. Let me see. Minnesota has 2. Michigan has 3. Mississippi has 6 national forests. Missouri has 1. Montana has several of them. Nebraska has 2. Nevada has 1. New Hampshire has 1. New Jersey has no national forest. New Mexico has 5 national forests. New York State has 1. Fingers Lake National Park. North Carolina has 5 national forests. North Dakota has none. Ohio has 1. Oklahoma has 1. There's several national forests in Oregon, One in Pennsylvania. Puerto Rico has one. Rhode Island has none. South Carolina has one. South Dakota has one. Tennessee has one. Texas has four. And Utah has one, two, three, four, five national forests. North Carolina has one. Virgin Islands has zero. Virginia has, I guess it's two. Because they had to rid of George Washington and Jefferson National Forest. I don't know if that's one, the name of one, or it's two separate ones. Washington State has five. Washington, D.C. has zero. West Virginia has two to three. Well, let's say two. Wisconsin has one to two. Wyoming has quite a few itself. Okay, now before I go to the phone line, since I am in Florida, okay, Aussie, Ola National Forest. Now that's the one. It's closest to our 4 acres. So right now it's temporarily closed due to, you know, we had a couple of storms that came through here. So I guess the park, you know, the rangers are doing stuff to, you know, get it back on track, you know, so it'll be safe for, you know, tourists and campers. But when you come visit us, that's one of the places where we'll take it. All right, Osceola National Forest was created by President Herbert Hoover's proclamation on July 10, 1931. It is named in honor of the noted Seminole Warrior Osceola. The forest is made up of approximately 200,000 acres of pine flatwood, cypress hardwood swamps in northeastern Florida, and is about 50 miles west of Jacksonville. Okay, now our 4 acres, Earthwell, is 90 miles from Jacksonville. So we're 40 miles away from this particular wilderness here. I mean, National Forest in Florida. Like I said, Florida has three. The Forest Administration headquarters is in Tallahassee. Okay, activities. A 28-mile section of the Florida National Scenic Trail is included in the park grounds. Other hiking trails in the park include Alusti Battlefield Trail, Trample Track Trail, Mount Carey Trail. There are two horseback riding trails. And the park is also open to hunters and fishermen, but you got to get permits. All right. Campsites. We have the site has ocean pond camping, and we have camping available at our place also. A landing group area available by reservation only. This is a 50-person private group area. Recreation activities include swimming, boating, camping, picnicking. Facilities include sand and a sand beach, boat launch for small boats, picnic shelter, large group grill, and restrooms and showers. You got to go to one of these national parks. So I'm just reading one, the closest one to our 4 acres, to our 4 acre private forest in northern Florida. All right, they have hunt camps also. Hunt camps includes hog pen, hog pen landing, Cobb, Wiggins, West Tower, East Tower. We got to find out more about that. All right, but that's one in three. Like I say, it's let's see. Yogi the Bear, well, not Yogi the Bear, but wildlife like bears, deers. Now, we have deer at our place that run through there. No bears. But at this national place, there is. But you know what? Typically, because when I went to Ocala National Forest, you saw bear signs and reinforced, you know, waste receptacles, trash cans that were bear proof. And although you know that the bears probably saw you, I didn't see any bears when I was there. So now, also within Osceola National Forest, which is, like I say, about 40 miles away, a 40-minute drive from our base camp up in northern Florida, within that is the Big Gum Swamp Wilderness. Okay, and let me see if I... Okay. The United States Congress designated Big Gum Swamp Wilderness in 1984. It has a total of 13,835 acres of land. Now, let's look up the definition of wilderness. Definition, of wilderness. Okay. Our definition of wilderness is, what does wilderness mean? A tract or region of uncultivated, uninhabited by human beings, an area essentially undisturbed by human activity, together with its naturally developed life community. All right? Example of wilderness. A wilderness can be found in a national park, like the Shenandoah Wilderness in Shenandoah National Park, or in a national forest like the John Muir Wilderness in Inyo National Park. A wilderness inside of another federally managed land may prohibit certain activities to preserve the wilderness character. A wilderness is an area of land that has been largely undisturbed by modern human development. Wilderness areas usually lack roads, buildings, and artificial structures. They provide a natural environment for plant and animal species and allow scientists to study healthy ecosystems. All right, let's see. What are the five qualities of the wilderness? It's got to be natural, preserve indigenous, solitude of primitive and unconfined recreation. Three, it's got to be undeveloped. Number four, untrampled. Now, at our 4 acres, and if you go to our Facebook page, It's Miles TV. We've got some. I'm not taking down any trees. That's one of the first things people talk about. Well, you got to take down a tree. No. We have natural open spaces there, and that's where we'll be building and conducting retreats and camping and living in the naturally open spaces. But I'm not cutting down one tree, not a bush. Let's see. All right, let me find my way back to the studio here. All right, so now with a lot of these, and this National Forest Land covers a lot because there's opportunities for individuals like yourselves where you can actually live in a lot of these places. With prop, you can bring your tent, or you can have your own cabin. So we'll explain all the rules on that, and we can do this in various parts of the United States. But it's these places are what I call a part of the real United States of America. These places are off the grid. Okay, let's see. Let me get back to my studio. And the embarrassing thing about this, I went to Ocala National Forest maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and I didn't know it was a national forest. And then I didn't know about the two other national forests, and I didn't realize how close our 4 acres is to a national forest. No, it's 40 minutes away. So, but now that I know, particularly with the national forest, which contains a wilderness area, which is over 13,000 acres, now I know how to market the place. So, but we'll be having built retreats here where we'll be building cabins, building tiny homes, and doing educational stuff. And also provide a spot for people that just need to get a fresh start for some reason. Let's see, I'm finding my way back to the studio. So like I say, on our Facebook page, It's Miles TV, we've got a number. We got at least 2 pie charts. let's see. You have 2 pie charts and the statistics there, like say over 10 million, and we can show you how to join that club of 10,600,000. That's a nice size club. We can help you join that club. All right, wait a minute, people. Okay. Now my board's frozen. Okay, wait a minute. Okay. Let me see if this works. All right, we're going to be going to the... Oh, man. All right, let's see if this works.
Hi, folks. In this video, I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it, and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second, and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre. And that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona near Sholo, Arizona that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas, and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land, okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with usually if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in, and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash. This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. For the cabin, it cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14. Downstairs is living area, dining area, bathroom, kitchen. Upstairs, I have a loft, bedroom, and an office. In my other videos, I take you on a complete walkthrough of this cabin, so watch those if you want to see how the cabin is as large as it is and functional on the inside. Up there on my roof, you see my solar panels. That's a 350-watt solar system that provides all of my electricity needs for lights, TVs, water pumps, all miscellaneous gadget, laptop, TV, run my vacuum, and everything else off of a 350-watt system. That 350-watt system cost me under $3,000. $2,000 for the cabin, $3,000 for the power system of solar electricity, and I use propane. I have a propane tank in the back of the cabin, and I have a propane furnace, fridge, stove, and on-demand water heater, and those cost me just about $200 for an entire year. And we have cold winters here, folks. Under $200 for an entire year for all of my propane. That is the only utility bill I have. I do not pay for electricity. I do not pay for water because I drilled my own water well. Before I drilled my own water well, though, I hauled water in. But drilling a water well on a piece of property is not that hard. You can either do it yourself or hire somebody to do it. So I have no monthly utility bills. I have a house that's completely paid for. And I have freedom. A freedom that you can't get when you're under the pressure of a mortgage and utility bills. I want you to take just a minute and think about what you could do with your life if you had no house payments and no utility bills. And I'm telling you, it is completely possible. I'm not going to go into any details of how to get out of the house that you're in. You're going to have to figure that out and talk to some professionals for some help that way. All I'm here to do is tell you it's completely possible. Now, some of you are looking at the cabin and saying, yeah, but I couldn't possibly live in anything that small. This cabin was designed specifically for additions to be built on any of three sides. As you can see, the cabin has no windows on any of the three sides. There is a window in the back door glass. The sides are 14 by 14. The cabin was built to have shed additions built on all three sides. This cabin is 400 square feet approximately inside with 200 square foot footprint. When you add on additions, you could add on an additional 400 square feet on either side and off the back, giving you anywhere from 800 to 1,200 square feet. The great thing about building a small cabin to start out with, though, is it gives you a place to live when you build on your additions, and that way you can wait and live very cheaply without any house payments or utility bills, and then when you have the money, you can build on the additions to expand the cabin. That's very good for a single person or a young couple who don't have children because you don't need a whole lot of space to start off with. This way you can save for it, build on as you want to, have the additions, have the extra room if that's what you want. Now, I live full-time in this cabin. I live by myself, but my girlfriend comes up here on the weekends, and we stay together, and let me tell you, it's perfectly comfortable. We don't feel cramped at all, and we'd much rather have a small place like this. It takes a lot less money to heat, takes a lot less money to cool, it's a lot easier to clean, it's just a fantastic home. Now, I'm not trying to push you into building a home exactly like mine. I'm just trying to provide you with some ideas. If you wanted to come up with different ideas, a different plan, that's just fine by me. But if you are interested in learning how to build a home like mine, I do have an ebook available and a printed book available called Simple Solar Homesteading. Go to www.simplesolarhomesteading.com. You can learn how to build a cabin like mine or at least get some great ideas for building your own home. Now I want to repeat, I own my land. I have a house that I built for under $2,000. I have a solar electric system that I have for under $3,000. I use propane, which costs me under $200 a year. I have no house payments. I have no utility bills. If you want a life like this, it is very possible. You can stop listening to the media, and you can stop being put under society's pressures to live in the type of houses that everyone tells you you have to live in. You can live very inexpensively, and you can do this at an age, at any age, whether you're older or younger. If you're younger and you start in a place like this, imagine the amount of money that you would have to retire on, with no house payments, no utility bills, and freedom. Thank you for joining me, folks. Please watch the rest of my videos for more detailed information on each of the systems and a complete walkthrough of the cabin.
Okay, and that's one of the activities that, because you can bring or build it, a lot of these national forests, you can, you got to follow the rules, though. Build your own cabin. They have private cabins within many of these national forests that are rented out to private individuals. And I would say these national forests in the United States, like I say, they're in 40 out of the 50 states. If it can be a lifestyle that you can live, or if you need to start over, there are communities within these national forests that can show you how you can live sustainably and get back on your feet financially. There's quite a bit there. So we'll cover more. We'll probably cover this topic at least no less than once, but maybe 1 to 4 times a month. We're going to cover this topic of national forest, and rural energy. As well. All right. So today is, what's today's date? And for a moment, I'm looking to, okay. Rural, and just give me a moment, folks. Okay. It's not coming out the way I want it. Where's my studio at? All right, so now I got to refresh my page. Well, what I'll do is as soon as my page, because I'm on my phone, then I'll go to the phone, right, and then I'll look for this other audio clip. All right, 309 area code. Your mic is open.
Good morning. Man, I've just been sitting
here listening to you.
I've been listening to this whole show, and it's all information I love, you know, giving somebody options, giving them an opportunity to learn something they don't know, being able to be independent. You know, that could change people's lives right there, just, you know, not having that monthly expense. And, you know, say
right.
It costs you more than $2,000, you know, for the frame and stuff of it, because you went a little bigger. You know,
right.
Say you did a little more than what he did in his cabin. how much is it cost?
Yeah, because his cabin, as he explained it, his cabinet, as he explained it, you can expand, you can add on to that.
Right.
Yeah, you can add on to it.
Yeah, no, that's the best part. I mean, you can make it any size you want. He says, my cabinet's 14 by 14. But,
right.
You know, people can have a 20 by 20. They can have a 25 by 30. I mean, it depends on your family and what you really need, you know.
That's true.
But you can have anything you want, but if you looked at what a 14 by 14 cost in the framework, now you have that signal. You know that this is not like an automobile. When you buy a new car, it depreciates the second that you drive it off the lot. But the second you stand this up, you not only appreciate it, but it appreciates in value.
Right.
So, you know, the thing becomes value, and that's what this is, you know, the opportunity for people to understand how much value they are. You know, not only the things that you acquire in life, but how do you acquire them and what you're becoming after you acquire them.
Right. Right. Now, Chris, now yeah. with your building technique method, let's put give me some dimensions. Give me some dimensions in of the cost and putting together the, you know, the basic frame for a building.
Well, the one thing about it is whatever square footage you want, you can start out with 8-foot sidewalls, and ever how big you want to do it, it will cost you roughly $20 a square foot for that material. Now, it's going to take you a few hours to put it together, but once you put it together, it becomes four times what it was in value.
Okay.
So what is your time worth? You know, that's the key thing behind this is you're not only gaining something that you're getting by standing it up, you're gaining appreciation. And now we talked about, you know, just doing some addition here, but this is multiplication. And anytime you multiply, it's awesome. You know, I mean, we know it just grows so much faster. So, but every time you add one of these to it, it also begins your multiply. So there's so many ways that you can continue to grow yourself. And we do know one of them, you know, is put a greenhouse in there that actually makes you money. Build a greenhouse that'll feed you, but also make your bank account grow faster than any amount of money you're sticking in it just by investing in the right thing. You know, that's the koi fish. I don't know if anybody's aware of them, but, you know, when I found out you can buy a baby koi for $20, that means I can buy five of them for $100, a gift of $100 to somebody that doesn't have anything.
Mm-hmm.
In 10 years, that'll be $100,000. And they can watch it grow, and it grows, you know, if they're even gold and stuff, you know, they look like gold, but this is actually something that grows and turns into an amazing amount of money for doing something and giving something life, giving it a nice life too. You know, it's not like you're giving it a bad life, you're giving it a nice life, and it's going to give you a nice life in return. But, you know, that's just one thing. But being able to feed your children, that's priceless. Being able to feed anyone, that's priceless. So,
right.
You know, if we have a way, you know, I mean, we can produce this material. It comes from a machine, but it also was made from other machines you had already bought in the past, and you threw them away in the junkyard. You know, if you jumped with a purpose and gave people hope, you will give them homes. You will give them honor. You can start using that H in any way you want. But it's what you do And that's, you know, I like the, you know, the whole, everything you said today in the podcast. I mean, it all meant something. It was all for a reason. I appreciate it because, you know, it just kind of gives people an enlightenment of what is happening right now. I kind of came in a little bit late on the show this morning. It was because I was being intentional somewhere else, but it was at PICTV. And we have an opportunity to reach millions. So I spent a few minutes in there first. So go ahead, buddy.
Okay. Right now, you said $200 per square foot. Hello?
Yes, I'm here, buddy.
Can you hear me?
You say...
You said $200 per square foot.
No, $20 a square foot gives you that. $200 a square foot is probably where you would be with a finished product.
All right, so you said $20 per square foot. So let's say we've... all right, hold it. It's 14 by 14. That's 196 square feet times 20. Oh man, that's a good deal. $3,920. Now that'll give you the basic
frame. That'd be the frame.
All right, that's very reasonable. Very, very. I mean, affordable, sustainable. Okay. Now I guess the first step. Is a person needs to come to you with a design, or what if they don't have a design or nothing like that? They just want a building.
We've got some designs, but if they just want something, anything they want, I mean, we want to meet their need because that's what we're trying to do. We want to meet a need, right. And they also will get what they want by meeting the need. So we want to make them happy. And one of the things that I've noticed is if you make someone happy, it'll make you happy. And
right.
That's just something the way I want to feel. You know, I know that people, you know, you never know what they're going through. You know, people don't know what I'm going through. But at the same time, I've got to show that we can break through. And if we can reach people and let them know, you know, this stuff doesn't cost that much money. It's just whether or not you're ready to change what's going on, be the change you want to see, start saving your life, saving others' lives, and doing something that will give our children a legacy to live on forever because, you know, you don't have to necessarily build this project for yourself. You can get the community involved to build that project with you. But whenever they want to get one built, go help them. You know, step up in at another time and go help them. So you can pay it forward and it'll be all paid back. And, you know, that's what this whole program that HOPE is about, you know, housing our people everywhere. It's to give you a program. They can stay in your community forever because, you know, you are humans on planet Earth, right? So this belongs to you. That program is yours. And it's for every child out there to be able to explore who they are ever going to be and for every adult to figure out that they haven't found out. You know, there's so much that's still out there that this world is full of that people need to explore, you know, and not necessarily leave and go there, but you can make a difference there, and you don't have to ever be there. I make a difference in people's lives on other continents every day, and when I see them, you know, they call me on the phone, and I get to have a video chat, and I'm seeing, you know, the kids are talking to me, waving at me, the grandparents, and they're also, and I'm watching how they're living. But you know what? They're happy. They don't have the technologies that we have. and they're happy because what they do have, they're thankful for. You know, it's one thing that's hard about us anymore. We're not thankful. We just kind of like expect. We're more of an expected kind of society. And if I got this job and this, well, this is who, well, guess what? No. That means you should be able to have a little more time to help someone else achieve and get to a status of feeling that they're that superior, because everybody's superior. And you're only as strong as your weakest link. And right now our weak links are costing us more money than it would cost to get them picked up, to make them strong, to let them realize that there is a future, that they matter. You know, people's lives are all different. No one's lived the same. But you know me, I'll get on a rant. So I'll answer some questions, though. $20 a square foot, you can get a frame. If it goes up from, you know, every foot that it rises, if you want it 9 foot tall, 10 foot tall, 12 foot, 14 foot, whatever you want, add 10% each time. And then you got the cost. I figured it at 8 foot, give you a price. If you want it 9 foot, add 10%. You want it 10, add 20. That's where it works. That's how it works. It's very easy. It's very simple. I wanted our elementary students to be able to do that math, and they can, because that's what we teach them.
Right. Okay. Wait a minute. I'm trying to juggle things here. Okay, now, the what's the closest location do you have in Florida for, you know, one of these machines you have that can produce the
The closest to you would be Lafayette, Louisiana, or maybe Woodstock, Georgia.
Georgia's probably closer.
I would say that Woodstock,
Georgia's
Georgia
right
probably
above Florida.
Interstate 10 runs the. I was gonna say Interstate 10 runs the whole Gulf Coast, and I can bring stuff from Houston. So.
Right. Well, we're near 75 and 10.
Yeah, that would be running up into Georgia. So I'd say Woodstock would probably be the run. That you would probably get supply from. Mm-hmm.
Now, when you factor in shipping, about the ballpark figure, because that's an expense people need to look at also.
The shipping is totally separate, because everybody's will be different. You know, somebody right outside Woodstock is liable to be giving us a call. You know, it won't cost us hardly anything to ship it to them. So, if nothing else, they can come over and pick it up with a flatbed trailer.
Well, that's true. That's true.
So you can come right to my thing. I'll give you every component. You'll see that it's a jigsaw puzzle. All you got to do is put it together. Here's your blueprint, and it'll show you. A piece goes here, and B piece goes here, C piece, D piece, ABC, 1, 2, 3. Because once you get the ABCs done, that's where you stand the trusses, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So you just put them on, and they go right there. They're already there. The stud that you stood up is where that truss stands. So everything's marked.
Right.
As you build it, everything else just lines up.
All right. Let me see. Picking up, that would be an option. And that's what a lot of people, I noticed with, what's the guy out of Newport, Incredible Tiny Homes. He has quite a few people that, I mean, they drove a long way. Well, they made, an enjoyable road trip, and they picked up their tiny house. So That is an option. And you know what? It'll probably be the least expensive option.
You know,
if you arrange to pick it up
is,
yourself.
If you did, it very well could be. It depends on how far you're traveling and you're paying double the fuel. If you're pulling a trailer the entire direction, both directions, and you're moving multiple states, you might want to think twice about it. For the
now,
time frame,
if
you wind up jumping in.
Depending on the dimensions, because let's say, because you're buying, because you can put this together like an erector set.
Right.
You know, rent a rider truck or a U-Haul truck and, you know, put the parts in the back of that, and you don't have to worry about, you know, that would be one way to do it, I think. Instead of having it already assembled, put it in the back of a U-Haul or some kind of box truck or whatever, rider truck, and then when you get to your destination, then you assemble it the way you want to. I'm just thinking out loud on that one.
Yeah, and now let me give you a set of dimensions on size of material. If you were building something that was a 10-foot by 10-foot, and I actually a building, and that was the truss material, everything. It did not stack more than 6 inches tall, and it was not 4 foot wide, and you had all the framing material. So that little stack, 6 inches by 4 foot wide, and then you go by the length. So it could be, you know, 12, 14, 16, whatever. I mean, you can have whatever length material you need for your trusses. They come solid length. So you're not going to be putting two pieces of material together and thinking there's a mending plate going to hold that. This is one solid piece of material that all you got to do is lay it out in jigsaw, and it's happening. So, you know, you build a couple of walls. That's what I suggest always in the beginning, is you build a couple of walls and you lay them down. And then you set the track on the walls the way you want to design the roof. And once you do that, you take out your jig, the little pieces, because we'll tell you exactly what the measurement is. Like, you know, go out to the middle of that track on the bottom and measure up 45 inches. All right. That's where your peak is going to be. So you make, that's where you attach that piece to. And then you put it out to the end of how long that track is and what the piece is that's going to go inside of it. Because there's a piece that'll snap right inside that track on that jig that you're building. And when you snap all these pieces in, that's when you have the webbing all sitting in place and everything. And all you got to do is start putting screws in it, because it'll show you right where to put every one of the pieces of webbing. So you'll get all the snow loads and you'll exceed everything that you need to have. So it makes it safer and stronger for you. And it's very easy. You just lay it down on the ground and put it together.
Well, I wish you had one of those machines down here in Florida someplace.
I can order a machine in 4 months right now for me to get one.
Okay.
But right now, I got machines that will make 2 feet of material per second, and they're sitting in idle. And I don't want them sitting
in
idle.
Okay, well, you got one of them in Georgia, so.
Yeah, I got one in Georgia ready to go.
All right, that's the closest. Hold on now. What part of Georgia is it in again?
Woodstock.
Let me look that up. I'm gonna see how far that is from where we are. Let's see, Woodstock, Georgia. Georgia. Okay. much. I'm looking at the map. All right, that's in the upper part of the state. In Cherokee County, well, like I say, Georgia is above Florida, so we can probably pick it up. And matter of fact, let's see, Woodstock. Georgia to let's see, Jasper, Florida. How long is that? All right, well, it's not bad. It's from Jasper, Florida, where we have our little forest, to Woodstock is 4 hours and 45 minutes. I may as well say 5 hours. So, well, it's anywhere from 4 hours and 45 minutes to 5 hours and 31 minutes. So, you know, we were talking about a day trip. If you go in one direction, it's 4 hours and 45 minutes. If you go in another direction, it's 5 hours and 31 minutes. So that's not bad, so to speak. Let's see. Now, let me get back to my studio. We started the program off today talking about national forest, and the person that told me about it, like I said, I had been in a national forest like 3-4 years ago. I didn't even know I was in one. Okay. And then I didn't know that there's a whole lot of things I didn't know that she enlightened me to. Her name is Connie. Some people call her the Big Mac. And she calls in because she can really run it down. I just had a simple, amazing paradigm shift when she told me about these national forests. So where I'm at in Florida, we have 3 national forests. And as I stated at the beginning of the program, there are a lot of 60% of the forests in the United States are owned by private entities, individuals, families, trusts, estates, corporations, privately owned 60%. That's 10,600,000 people. That's a nice size club. However, and I'm going to Carlos here in a moment, we got like 320 million people in the country. So let's see, 320 million. Let's see. We have a certain percentage then. Wait a minute. I think like 320 million plus people, about maybe 3.5% of the total population of the United States controls and our owns is in private hands the forest areas that we have in the United States. And there's various definitions. Some definitions say you have to have at least an acre and a quarter, maybe an acre and a half, some or less. But let's say an acre and a half. You need to have an acre and a half of land that is mostly covered by trees, and the trees must be at least 16 feet in height, tall. So based on that definition, we have a 4-acre forest in North Florida. So once we start having retreats here, like I said, we have a Madison State Park, which is maybe 15, 20 minutes away from where we are there. This is better. If you come to Florida, forget about Disneyland and Universal Studios and all those places. Visit, they got some terrific parks here. Madison State Park, we're like 15 to 20 minutes away from there, and then we're 40 minutes away from Osceola National Forest, which contains, now Osceola National Forest, once again, is 200,000 acres. It's a pretty big spread. And within that 200,000 acres, there's Big Gum Wilderness, and that's over 13,000 acres. So you have, all kinds of recreational activities, camping, boating, swimming, hiking, animal species, including bears, but they won't bother you. Unless you bother them, I'll put it that way. But there's a whole lot, you get in these places and you'll say, particularly if you're coming from a large city, is the real United States, the real United States. So private individuals there's a whole lot there. All right, I just got to, she can't call in because she's working. So Connie, I'm going to just call her Connie Mac. I'm giving her a shout out because she was the one that made me aware of these national forests. And there's a lot of other information I haven't put out there yet, but how you individually fit into that stuff. Although it's a big club, but, only about, 3.5% of the population have forest land. That can be classified with. They're different definitions. So, once again, if you go to our Facebook page, which is It's My House TV, and then the first thing you want to come across, and let me go there to the director. Okay, you go to It's My House TV, and then under Vauban Schwartzfeld, you'll see there's two pie charts. 60% of the forest land in the United States is privately held by families, individuals, trusts, estates, corporations. That's over half in private hands. 30% is the federal government, okay, with these national forests. Then state and local, I just mentioned a few minutes ago, Madison State Park is a Florida state park in the state of Florida. Owns that. That's about 15 minutes away from us. Then some cities, I guess, in Florida's land. So that's one pie chart. The pie chart below that is 10.6 million Americans or American entities have ownership, and it breaks that down. 38% of family forest, just individual families, that they have forest. And then 20% of that, which is still private, is corporate, 9% state, 2% local. Then as you scroll down, there's about three pictures of me. Now, I'm in somebody else's forest building, help building a, it was an Earthship week. So we built a small cabin using Earthship methodology, you know, just stuff that people threw away. And then the rest of the pictures I took except for one. The picture of the three guys, now that's on our 4 acres. So that's what our little 4 acre forest looks like from that angle. Then we is an aerial shot. I did not take that, but you can see how it's heavily wooded. But there's some open, we're not going to remove any trees from this. We're not going to clear any trees. But there's some open natural spots where we can actually build and set up solar panels and you know, generate energy that way. The next picture, scrolling down, is that's the dirt road. That's the front. I'm standing at the front of the property. All right, which will really be on the left-hand side in this picture. It's quiet there, people. And at night, black. Pitch black. Okay. Scrolling down before that, now once again, a forest must have about an acre, a quarter acre, or an acre and a half. All right, we're at four, and you have to have trees that are at least 16 feet tall. So you see the guy standing in the picture to the left, bottom left-hand part of those trees are well over 16 feet. And then we have a little clearance area below that and another one below that, and then another picture of an aerial view. And then we have definitions. What's the definition of a forest according to the UN? I'll let you read that on your own. Then we have another definition of a forest. And then is what is the best definition of a forest? What is the definition of forest in geography? And then what makes a forest? So all that is in with along with 13 pictures, including two pie charts. So we can have something made by Chris in one place and then set it up and assemble it where people can, you know, learn and do things. So, all right, I got to find my studio again. Wait a minute. Carlos, I'm coming to you momentarily. It is a lot more information on the National Forest and then what you can do legally in those forests, which it's, after we reveal some of this information, some of you might decide, you know what, I'm going to live part, I mean, I'm sure there are people that live in various national forests year-round. You can't camp out in one space on a permanent basis, but they typically allow you, they're pretty liberal with the amount of time that you can spend. And it's like we have three national forests here in Florida. Basically, I can just rotate between those three year-round and call it a day. And I have basically everything I need right within those national forests. So anyway, 703, Carlos, I believe, your mic is open.
Hey, how's it going, gentlemen? I'm here.
Fine.
Yeah, so stressing out a little bit.
go ahead.
Just,
we're listening.
Need to do my breath work and meditation and put things in perspective. A lot of stuff happening really, really fast. So just trying to keep it all under control. Lots of people in greenhouses.
Right. Now, with the greenhouses, let's start. If you open up a store, you did that last week. So for people, well, run that back for people who missed out on what you originally announced.
I was trying to raise money for these filings for protecting the buildings. You know, so we have these greenhouses that grow fish plants and mushrooms. As it turns out, they're highly, highly profitable because 1 square foot of mushroom production area produces 10 pounds of mushrooms per week. And those mushrooms can sell anywhere from $8 to $10 a pound. Microgreens apparently are even more profitable even than mushrooms. So I think if you did one of these and just did nothing but mushrooms and microgreens and used the fish to fertilize that, you would have a greenhouse in a very small area that would make a lot of money. And it's kind of crazy when you do the numbers, like if you look at my greenhouse, which is a 10 by 24, I'm sorry, 10 by 20, I allocated like one third of it, to mushrooms, which I think I said, if I only had like 70 square feet of mushrooms, that's 70 times 10 per week that it would produce just in the mushroom production, which is quite a bit of money, which means, we could actually price these a lot higher than we were thinking because, this thing would pay for itself like, 12 times over very, very quickly. Of course, I'm talking commercial, for a nonprofit, what we want to do is price them as low as we can so that people can make a living from them. I was talking to a lady from Clubhouse that has access to some commercial property in Lancaster, Antelope Valley, California, which interestingly enough is where I used to live for about 6 years. It's the high desert. These greenhouses were actually designed for the high desert. That's where they flourish. And that's because in the high desert, everybody uses evaporative cooling to keep their houses cool. They're also known as swamp coolers. And this greenhouse incorporates a swamp cooler in the top portion of the thermal battery, which for people that don't know what a thermal battery is, it's a container full of water that's painted black, and that's what stores the solar energy, just like a battery, inside of the greenhouse. So at the top of the solar battery or the thermal battery, we put an evaporative cooling system that now pushes cold, moist air into the mushroom chamber, which allows you to grow mushrooms in the middle of the desert, species that you normally couldn't grow, that would require wintertime type conditions. Mushrooms typically most mushrooms can grow at around 70 degrees and 90% humidity. So that was the, that's, we're running the numbers on a 3,000 square foot commercial version, and the production is just, pretty incredible. So we think that the investors are going to be probably drooling over this. I've already got some friends of mine that are real estate developers contacting me. Everybody's coming out of the woodwork now. So, there's a lot of people interested in these. And, of course, my mission is to use all profits that are generated from the commercial stuff to do my real mission, which is to feed and house homeless vets. And we're looking at doing a homeless vet village in Lancaster, California, which is where I used to live, which is pretty, I don't know how to put it, symbolic, that I would return back to where I lived to build something that's going to be pretty incredible. These villages will also produce more energy than they consume. So, Chris had mentioned that he's got a connection to L.A., to the mayor of L.A. It may be the same connection for all I know because this was through Clubhouse. And this lady also is working with the mayor of L.A., and they declared L.A. County a national emergency because of the homeless problem. And as it turns out, she's also doing a program with active duty vets, active duty military, in order to assure that they get rent-controlled and affordable housing when they're in active duty, you know, because lots of people will take advantage of military folk because they have a steady paycheck and they'll start, you know, gouging. So, you know, she's been on a mission to make sure that you know, any rental properties that they rent are not being used in order to take advantage of the people that are fighting for our freedom. So, you know, we're both on the same mission in that respect, and that's where I'm at right now. And I'm still, you know, I'm trying to license the intellectual property and the technology in order to bring in the money to do what we're doing. And, of course, we're working with lots of people that are interested in using the technology. You know, Hope with Chris, you know, is something we could partner with in order to build tiny homes and greenhouses that feed and house people. And then, of course, there's the, you know, there's the humanitarian, and then there's the commercial applications. And I'm just trying to push the ball up the hill, you know. So on eBay, I made a little mini greenhouse that just grows mushrooms and microgreens, which, by the way, are the most profitable part of even the commercial greenhouse. So, you know, somebody putting up one of these little greenhouses in their own home, growing themselves mushrooms and microgreens, they'll be saving – that little greenhouse will pay for itself, you know, thousands of times over the life of using it. So, you know, that's what I'm doing, and I need all the help I can get, and it's been a huge struggle. You know, I've been working at this for around 11 years. And it seems like the puzzle pieces are finally coming together. Thank you.
Now, the greenhouse, what's the, you know, in the square footage of that?
The mini greenhouse? Well, first of all, what's the different products?
The one that you have.
The mini greenhouse.
Where
the
you
one
can,
in my backyard?
You know, actually, yeah, that one, yeah.
Yeah, so the first one I'm talking about that I put plans up for is just for one that grows, you know, that grows mushrooms and microgreens, and it's very, very small form factor. It's like 2 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet, you know, so it's a little box. It's a frame with a plastic cover over it, two shelves. You put the mushrooms on the top shelf. You put the microgreens on the bottom shelf, and I publish some plans that teaches everybody exactly what they need to buy and what they need to do to get that accomplished. Those plans are $17.99. I haven't gotten to putting the plans for the greenhouse that I have in my backyard that's made from a 10 by 20 carport. And, you know, I want to do that. And I also need to put up plans for Kristen's tiny homes plans. So, you know, those are the three models. And then, of course, there's a fourth model, which would be a greenhouse that's made with steel frames, like the type that Chris produces, and that would be plans for that model haven't been developed yet. They still have to be developed. So that's where I am on the plan end of it. And, of course, all of these plans eventually can become kits that those are sold through eBay. And then, of course, you know, we've talked about on your previous shows how you can go up the ladder, you know, from an idea, plans, to a kit, to assembling them, to a display store that has them pre-assembled. But you had a question about the one in my backyard, the one that I made from
the
carport.
Yeah, the how many square feet?
That's 200 square feet. That's the 10 by 20.
Okay.
It's made from a 10 by 20 carport. And, you know, I figured that one third of it would be mushrooms, which is a third of 200. What is that? What is that, 70-something? 3 times 7 is 21. Yeah, it's under 70 square feet of it would be mushrooms. And, you know, I designed it to not be, like, packed to the gills. you know, it's a hobby greenhouse. I want to be able to walk in there and enjoy it and not, you know, be packed to the gills. You know, you could increase the production more if you, you know, packed every square inch of it. But I'm trying to create greenhouses that are actually, you know, eco-friendly and that, you know, the humans can go in there and enjoy what they're growing, not the typical, you know, how can we cram as many fish in a fish tank? You know, how can we cram as many mushroom bags in a chamber? How can we cram as many plants, you know, in a chamber, which is the typical business thinking, you know, maximize ROI, you know, forget about the health of the fish and the plants and the mushrooms, or the humans for that matter. As long as you maximize ROI, you know, you're doing good, which is what's killing the planet right now.
Now, the ballpark for cost for building that, you told us once, but for the new people that didn't hear it.
I think the parts are around $7,000-$8,000, you know, with shipping costs now. You know, the assembly time is probably a couple of days. You know, commercially, I should probably be selling it. You know, I was just talking to this lady that does the real estate development. You know, the people that were bidding on these properties, you know, through the state, you know, and of course they're connected to the politicians and, you know, they were talking about like $200,000 per tiny home is what they were trying to sell them for. To the, you know, and this is from taxpayer money. And I heard that number and I was just like, my God, you know. Anyways, yeah. So, you know, commercially these could be priced, you know, shit, if they generate $30,000 a month, you know, what would you price it at commercially, you know? So, you know, we're looking at models like, you know, where we just go in and build it and just, you know, pay the homeowner to have it on their property, you know, because of the amount of money this thing generates.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. You got a goose that lays, you know, $30,000 eggs every month. You know, are you going to sell it for $30,000? And I'm talking commercial. No. You know, what would a commercial person do? They would say, okay, $30,000 times 12 months is blah, 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 blah. You know, we're going to sell it for a large chunk of that amount, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's how the money people operate.
Now, what if people just wanted to build one? And for personal use.
Well, that, you know, I'm trying to help people with that. You know, that's what I want
right,
to do is
right.
Help people for personal use. You know, I mean, I want them to feed their families, you know, but, you know, if they turn it into a commercial operation, you know, then we've got patents that cover, you know, their commercial activity. So, you know, I don't mind people, you know, feeding their families and, you know, even, you know, making a living out of it. But if they're going to be building them and selling them and, you know, marketing them and making money off of them, then, of course, you know, that's commercial. But the whole intent of these greenhouses was to teach people how to feed themselves, you know, when times are difficult. So, you know, that's the mission. But the, you know, the people that are really drooling are the commercial people that are looking at you know, the money potential. You know, so, you know, humanitarian, I consider to be considered, you know, a good cause. But in that situation, you know, I want to know who the humanitarian organization is, because I don't want to partner. You know, if the humanitarian organization is making millions off of it and, you know, sending $1 to the people that need it, well, those are the type of humanitarian organizations I do not want to associate with, you know. If they're making millions and then it's actually going to helping people, that's a different story, you know. And there are ways to find that out. You know, there's websites now that rate nonprofits on how much of the money that they receive actually goes to the people that they claim they're helping. And, you know, I want to be working with organizations that are in the high 90, you know, hopefully the 98th percentile or higher, so that I know, you know, that you know, they're commercializing them through nonprofits in order to help people, not, you know, to buy Lamborghinis and Learjets and things like that, which a lot of those are sort of, you know, used for.
Okay.
I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. It does. Okay, well, let's see. Chris, anything else? Today, what's today's date? It's the 20th of December.
Yeah.
Yeah, almost Christmas.
Yeah, it's coming
or whatever
up.
Holiday people celebrate is Hanukkah. I don't know the dates for Hanukkah, but Hanukkah is celebrated over 8 days, I think. But
they have, they light a candle
it's
every
the holiday.
They have the menorah, and I think they light a candle every day. And a friend of mine just put up a picture of the menorah. The candle wasn't lit yet. So I think they're getting ready to start lighting the candles. Yeah,
okay.
I should know. My stepdad was Jewish. So I always tell people I'm half Jewish because my stepdad was Jewish. But, I haven't been really much into the religious traditions, being a recovering Catholic.
Right.
Now,
okay.
Now I'm spiritual and I believe in God, but what I saw in those Catholic schools was pretty bad.
Man, I went to one myself. I went to the Massive Catholic for 3 years.
Oh, wow.
Let's see.
First through third grade?
What's that?
First through third grade?
No, I went 9th, 10th, and 11th. High school.
Oh, wow.
9th, 10th,
yeah.
And 11th. But I graduated from
another
school other than that. Yeah, well,
were they allowed to beat you?
Academic... What's that?
Were they allowed to beat you?
No, they didn't have any. There was nothing like that there. We're talking
okay,
about high
yeah.
school.
When I grew up in...
I even went to a Catholic day camp, in the summertime, and there was no discipline. I mean, nobody was never disciplined.
Yeah, well, I mean, I grew up in the 60s, and times were a little different back then. The corporal punishment, spare the rod, spoil the child. And that was
ingrained
in everybody.
Yeah, and let's see, in first grade, first to third grade, you can get a paddle. These are different schools. A paddle or, a ruler. You get smacked on the hand with a ruler. Or you get a paddle on the rear.
Yeah.
Of course, that's done in front of the whole class. But,
the public can leave.
But nothing beyond that. I probably got paddled twice. Sixth grade, seventh grade, they want to get paddled twice. Tap on the back of the hand with a ruler, probably maybe a couple of times, but there was no.
I don't know why I'm laughing.
See,
it's not really
also,
funny. Actually.
Now, back then, we're talking about 60s.
Yep.
What parents do way, at home. Man, I got the belt, the switch. Got to go picking on switch. The ironing cord, a yardstick. Then the next door neighbor.
Yeah.
Man, put it this way, parents. If parents then in the 60s and probably 50s, if they would judge then how the society is now. Most of those parents would have been incarcerated.
No, this is true. It would be
back
child
then. Everybody beat their
abuse.
Kids. What's that?
Yep. When I went to Catholic school, my parents had to sign a waiver to allow them to beat us. And my dad looked at her, or the lady, and he goes, "You guys need permission in this country?" Because we're from Ecuador.
It was nothing like that. But
in those times, do you need permission in this country? Pretty funny. Now that I think of it.
Yeah, nowadays, nowadays you can't lay your hands on them. Yeah, nowadays you can't. The thing is, nowadays, we did some podcasts on that years ago. You know, kids can hit you. They're not supposed to hit you. But
well, you know something, you can't hit them, but there's ways of punishment that you know, for example, taking away video games. You know, my kids, I'm like, you know, you're not doing your homework. And I say, you're playing video games, right? And they're like, and I go, that's a privilege, right? And I'm like,
right.
If you don't do your homework, I'm going to take the video games away. And they know when I tell them something that I'm not, you know, I'm not kidding. And they would do what they needed to do. For a while, you know, I'm ex-military. I would make them do push-ups. And I didn't care where
they were.
They could be in the middle of
the
restaurant.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I had my kids doing push-ups in the middle of M Street in Georgetown, you know. And I'll tell you what, they messed up one time, and, they, you know, they never did it again because they didn't want to be doing push-ups, you know, the embarrassment of doing push-ups in the middle of Washington, D.C., with cars driving by.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't care where the hell we were. You know, you could be in a Walmart, wherever, you know.
Yeah. Georgetown is crowded all the time.
I make them do 20 push-ups. But, you know,
I would say the most effective punishment.
The
most effective punishment used against me in high school was grounding. You can't go out.
Yep.
You're grounded.
But
I must say, I had a TV in my room and a phone. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't too bad.
It wasn't so bad, was it?
But, yeah, grounding, yeah, that straightened me out, particularly when I started driving. You know, not only are you grounded,
well, see,
but you can't use the car.
This is the thing. Did you grow up with a mom and dad or just a mom or just
mother
a dad?
And stepfather. Mother and stepfather.
Okay. Well, I grew up with just a mom, and she worked till 7:30 every night to put food on the table. You know, so she was not around, not by choice, you know, in order to provide for us. So, you know, she used to have to drive into D.C. for Maryland, and then she wouldn't get home till like 7 o'clock or so. But she would leave, you know, breakfast, lunch, and dinner in the refrigerator for us. You know, she always provided for us. But she wasn't there to control us, you know, and it's a pretty well-known fact that, you know, when single moms are raising children – and they have to take both roles of, you know, the father and the mother and also the provider, you know, the children are kind of left to do what they do. And if you've got kids like me that are sort of rambunctious, you know, we get into trouble, you know. And
right.
I got into a lot of trouble when I started getting older. What really helped me, I got into martial arts and gave me something to do. And then I joined the military. And
yeah, it helped to have kids in something structured, but I don't know, like, My parents, every year in high school, they would go, like, visit my grandparents down in New Orleans. And it's during the school year, so school was in session. So I was driving by that time, and I had the whole house to myself. But I knew there was a privilege, and if I messed that up, they would never allow me to have that kind of freedom again. And I'm pretty sure, you know, she probably had one of the neighbors look out. But I didn't have anybody in that house but me and a dog. That was it. I didn't want to mess up. Because, you know, now, you know, some people get in trouble for leaving their teenagers at home. And I was like, I was 16 driving a car, 16, 17. But what I looked at that is, and I don't want to blow that, so I didn't have anybody over that house but me when they were away for that, what, 1 or 2 weeks. So, all right, well, we're going to wrap it up for today. We'll be back tomorrow on getting our momentum together so we can get into the new year of 2023. Everyone have a good rest of the day.